From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we talk islands, both literal and the metaphorical. We look at the complicated history and present of Hispaniola, where a border separates the Dominican Republic and Haiti.
And there was so much real, you know, from the people, grassroots desire to really connect and really make this, you know, a porous border, a border that could be a border of life.
And we meet the Latinos of Hawaii.
Although I'm Mexican by blood, I'm Hawaiian and all these other nationalities by heart.
Plus, Peace Corps workers trying to fit in, an oil boom in North Dakota, and abstinence education in the DR. All this and more as we talk islands on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we're talking about islands. Now, just the word island can conjure up the image of paradise. Palm trees, the beach, beautiful tropical weather. But there's a flip side, isolation and everything it brings with it. This dual nature can create a unique kind of tension, a tension that can be found on the island of Hispaniola. Hispaniola is an island just east of Cuba, and it's divided in two. On the west side, there's Haiti, and on the east, there's the Dominican Republic. Last year, a ruling by the DR's highest court made thousands of people living in the Dominican Republic, most of them of Haitian descent, effectively stateless, lost on the island. Latino USA producer Antonia Cerejido reports on the long history of strife between the Dominican Republic and Haiti and what's happening now on the island.
On a Sunday afternoon, Joanne Sepin and his dad, Wilfredo Sepin, hang out together at Venus Restaurant, a Haitian place in Prospect Lefferts Gardens in Brooklyn.
I feel more Haitian than Dominican.
That's Joanne. His dad, Wilfredo, is Dominican. But since he grew up in Haiti and has a Haitian mom, well, let's just say he has a lot of Haitian pride.
Yo le dije que los haitianos son más inteligentes que los dominicanos. Because when we came to other country, we learned.
Joendy is telling his dad that Haitians are smarter, but Wilfredo replies, just keep talking.
Did you ever visit the Dominican Republic?
Yes, I've been, yes, yeah. Every vacation.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
what do
you think of it?
It's nice over there. Nice.
Wilfredo was beaming while Joandy talked to me. People. He proudly told me that his son speaks four languages, French, Creole, English, and Spanish. But the Dominican-Haitian love might just stay in the family. Joandy says that the Dominican news outlets promote negative stereotypes about the Haitians.
Listen, the news, the Haitian people is bad. You know, the Haitian people have the voodoo thing.
The Dominican-Haitian feud makes for fun banter between Joandy and Wilfredo. But the history of the relationship between the two nations is no joke. To truly understand how deep these roots go, we need to go back. Way back. To the late 1700s, when Haiti fought the first successful slave revolution. Haiti gained independence from France, while the Dominican Republic to the east continued to be governed by the Spanish crown. Almost two decades after gaining independence, Haitian President Jean-Pierre Boyer began his campaign to unite the island and defeated the Spanish crown in 1821. For 22 years, the island of Hispaniola was one nation. The Republic of Spanish Haiti. But then the Dominicans rebelled against the Haitians to gain independence. In fact, when the Dominican Republic celebrates their independence on February 27th, they are celebrating their independence from Haiti. They are the only Latin American country to celebrate independence from another country in the region. And over the next century, things between the nations didn't necessarily get easier.
Estimates go from 4,000 to upwards of 20,000 Haitians and Dominicans of Haitian descent in the Dominican Republic were murdered.
Julia Alvarez is a Dominican writer and professor at Middlebury College in Vermont. She is referring to a 1937 massacre, which is still denied by many in the Dominican Republic. Some know it as the Parsley Massacre. Here's how the rumor goes. The president at the time, Rafael Trujillo, had ordered anyone who said the word perejil, or parsley in Spanish, with a French-sounding R, to be killed.
When I was a little kid, I was taught that the Haitians were, you know, this enemy next door, that, you know, if I didn't eat my supper or go to bed, the Haitian cuckoo would come and take me away to Haiti, where they ate little Dominican kids.
Once Julia was an adult, she learned more about the actual history of both countries. And on the 75th anniversary of the massacre in 2012, Julia joined efforts with some colleagues to remember what happened.
We had a procession. We had a service. The people in the border town joined us on the border. We lit up the border with lights.
Julia says that hundreds of people from both sides of the border brought candles to honor the sad history. And they're still doing it every year. Yet their political relationship continues to be strained. Last year, in 2013, a court ruling made it so that anywhere from 24,000 to 200,000 people of Haitian descent who were born and grew up in the Dominican Republic were ineligible for citizenship.
Well, it's really complicated.
That's Aline Gestal. She's a freelance journalist who covered this court ruling. The woman who was at the heart of this case applied for a national ID card. She was denied on the grounds that her parents were considered irregular parents. They were irregular because of this technicality in which they were deemed, quote, in transit.
The general kind of legal understanding of what in transit means, it means you're, you know, you took a flight in and you're flying out or something like that and you happen to have your baby.
The Dominican courts defined in transit differently.
They kind of determined that anybody who was there kind of without documentation or had overstayed their visas or anything besides having all their paperwork in line was considered in transit. And this applied especially to a lot of farm workers who had come over on temporary work visas to work in the sugarcane fields. And a lot of those were at kind of the invitation of the Dominican state.
Most of these laborers in the sugarcane fields were Haitians who had crossed the border legally at the request of the Haitian state. Another aspect of this case that made this whole situation complicated is that the documentation in the DR is kind of a mess.
The birth certificate means something a little bit different in the Dominican Republic. It's something that you need to do a lot of things that you don't need it for here, like going to college. You would need your birth certificate to participate in a whole bunch of state kind of services. And so it's something that people need a lot, but it's not something that you necessarily get immediately when you're born.
One such person who did not get her birth certificate at birth is Daisy Toussaint.
Pero antes era muy común que los padres declararan a los hijos tardío. O sea, lo declararan con 2 o 3 años porque tienen que entrar al colegio.
Daisy explains how it was common practice for children not to get their birth certificate until they were old enough to enter school. She was born to a Dominican father and a Haitian mother, and since her father traveled a lot, when it came time for her to get her birth certificate, her mom ended up giving her her maiden name, Toussaint, a very common Haitian last name. But even before Daisy's last name ended up getting her into trouble years later, a bizarre childhood experience foreshadowed her strange relationship with the state and her status.
Cuando yo tenía un año y medio, mi escuálido cuerpecito se comenzó.
When I was 1.5 years old, my fragile body began to balloon for some unknown reason.
Decidieron internarme, pero no, mis venas no aparecían.
They decided to hospitalize me, but they couldn't find my veins.
Tuvieron que ponerme todos los sueros e inyecciones en la cabeza.
They had to give me the IV and all the shots into my head.
Bueno, y me dio un infarto, si se puede decir así, un paro cardíaco.
Well, I had a heart attack.
The doctors declared Daisy dead.
Como yo no tenía yo no estaba declarada ser hija de.
Since I didn't have a birth certificate and was the daughter of poor people.
Fue un poco difícil.
It was difficult to sign off on getting the body removed from the hospital.
But her mother was finally able to take what they believed was Daisy's body out of the hospital, and a wake was planned for that very day.
They had commissioned an ambulance to take me from the hospital to my home, and that same ambulance was going to take me from my home to the cemetery. The only person in the entire wake that sees me open my eyes is my mother. She grabs me out of the coffin and begins to run. She ends up taking me back to the hospital, where I'm declared not dead. At that point, the medics wouldn't let the press or the police come into the hospital, because they were the ones who had declared me dead that very morning.
It turns out that Daisy suffered from catalepsy, a condition that is characterized by rigid muscles and a lack of response to external stimuli. Daisy went on to become a writer, and she actually won a national award for a short story she wrote about catalepsy. After winning the award, she was invited to go to a book fair in Cuba. This is what happened when she applied for a passport.
They say they can't give me my passport because my last name is French. I had a birth certificate, an ID card, I studied, and everything was normal. But now... They tell me no. It's like erasing my entire past.
Since Daisy applied for a passport, she has been recognized formally by her Dominican father in court and is officially a Dominican citizen. Daisy still has not been able to leave the Dominican Republic. Her visa to come to New York for a book fair was denied. She was going to present her latest work, The Deaths of Daisy Toussaint.
I draw a parallel between the first death, the one by catalepsy, and my second death, my civil death.
Daisy has been lucky. But for others living in the Dominican Republic who don't have her profile, being recognized by the state can be very difficult. The 2013 court ruling received a lot of backlash. And since then, the Dominican government has established a program that allows Haitians who have been living in the DR to apply for residency. According to a report from the AP released in late August, more than 115,000 people have signed up through the program since it launched in early June. But only 275 have met the criteria. Ultimately, nationality isn't just an issue of whether you have papers. It's about how people identify. Alin Gestal, the reporter we heard from earlier, tells me about her experience talking to people in the DR.
Most of the people who have, you know, not been able to get their identity cards or were not able to register, they identify very strongly as Dominican. Juliana Antiguis-Pierre, who's one of the very famous cases, you know, when I asked her, do you feel Dominican? She said, I don't feel Dominican, I am Dominican.
Latino USA producer Antonia Cerejido. Coming up on Latino USA.
The chefs have the most power because if enough chefs say, I will buy so many pounds or so many kilos of mushrooms each week, they will grow them.
The organic farms of Cuba and the changing food economy on the so-called Communist Island. Stay with us, no se vayan.
A marcharte, ya lo sé, no pasa nada, tú siempre fuiste bueno en mantener la calma, tengo poco que perder, si no ves lo que puede ser, creer que no te olvidaré, es tenerlo todo al revés, mi
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today, islands. Now, ever wonder why a mango tastes sweeter outside of the United States? Well, Cuba, at least, gets 90% of its food production from organic farms. They're drawing travelers, including a famous San Francisco-area restaurateur, and changing the economics of food in communist Cuba. Reese Ehrlich has our story.
San Francisco restaurateur Narcy David checks out the fresh produce at a farmer's market here as shoppers bargain for the best price. He wants to buy fresh, ripe papayas to use in a cooking demonstration for Cuban chefs.
That's got a lot more flavor.
Mm-hmm.
I really would like to get as much color as I can.
David's trip is sponsored by the Green Cities Fund. It's an Oakland nonprofit, which, under terms of the U.S. embargo of Cuba, is awaiting permission from Washington to start a culinary school in Havana. In the meantime, it's sponsoring chefs like David to hold interchanges with Cubans wearing tall white hats.
When in Cuba, it's always good. It's just a general rule of thumb.
When you see something
that you need to grab it, because we could go up to the other market and they might have no papaya.
David buys the four juicy papayas and walks a few blocks to the workshop being held in a Paladar, one of the increasing number of privately owned restaurants in Cuba. He peels the fruit and pops it into a blender in order to make a picante sauce. Strangely enough, there are no habanero peppers in Havana. They actually come from Mexico. And David learned that Cubans generally don't like spicy food.
Now, somebody tell me here, how much of this pepper can I use? I want it to be hot, but not too hot.
She says three or four. He says one.
Uno, dos.
David is one of the founders of California Cuisine, which pioneered the use of fresh produce directly from local farms. He encourages Cuban chefs to do the same with local organic farmers.
The chefs have the most power, because if enough chefs say, I will buy so many pounds or so many kilos of mushrooms each week, they will grow them.
Under Cuba's traditional Marxist economic system, chefs had little power over the state-run supply system. That's beginning to change as Cuba shifts from big state-run enterprises to smaller, all-organic cooperatives and private farms. These changes became clear in a visit to one of those organic farms, the Organoponico Vivero Alamar, on the outskirts of Havana.
That's got to be turmeric.
Men chop up the yellow spice for packaging, one of the many products they grow and sell here. Isis Salcines, a leader of this organic farm, explains that co-op members plant 25 acres of tomatoes, lettuce, and other vegetables. Cuba now produces about 90% of its crops without using chemical fertilizers or pesticides, making it the largest per capita consumer of organic food in the world. But Salcines says using organic methods to feed Cuba's 11 million people isn't easy.
When you produce in an organic way, it's very hard. We learn to produce. It's very hard because you have to wear more, not so quickly like a chemical, but it's more healthy and the production is better.
Food in Cuba is far more plentiful now than a few years ago, but shortages remain and prices are very high for ordinary people. The U.S. embargo is partly to blame because it prohibits Cuba from earning hard currency by selling cigars, rum, sugar, or anything else to the U.S. In addition, Cuba has suffered from a series of disastrous hurricanes. The Cuban transportation system remains broken, with farmers having difficulty getting products to market. Walking through the fields, Salsina says co-ops like Vivero Alamar can help solve Cuba's food problems because they provide better incentives to the farmers. Co-op members here, for example, produce more in a shorter workday.
Here we work 7 hours and summer only 6. We have breakfast and lunch free. A special schedule for the woman who has children, they can enter 1 hour late for go to the school, the daycare. All of these, the people who were here, they feel happy, they feel honored. They belong for a long time in the farm.
Back at the Havana workshop, Cuban chefs note that both private and state-owned restaurants have improved the quality of their food over the last few years. As one says, they feel part of a new era in Cuban cooking. She says for many years, Cuban cuisine was sleeping. It was very poor. We're all involved in trying to make it better. For Latino USA, I'm Reese Ehrlich in Havana.
To get a recipe for Narcy David's sauce cubana, visit our website, latinousa.org. Now, when you say Hawaii, some people might think about Hollywood vacationers and a Pacific Island laid-back sensibility. But not many people know that our 50th state is also the country's most diverse. And with an influx of Latinos, it's becoming even more so. Our show's founding executive producer, Maria Martin, tells us more.
Tourists and natives alike drive to Pupukea Beach on Oahu's North Shore to savor the waves, the sand, and the sunsets. And also this evening, the Peruvian dishes that Hugo Vargas is selling from his brightly painted food truck.
How are you?
Good.
How
may I help you?
I'm going to get that head of the gallina.
Okay. Yeah. All right, I'll be done with this later.
Vargas, who's in his 20s, lives in Colorado, but he's considering making the move to Hawaii.
Well, the beautiful place that is Hawaii, number one. Two, I wanted to bring the delicious cuisine that Peru has to this area to see if it would work out and possibly do it permanently.
If Vargas does decide to make the move, he won't be alone. According to the last census, nearly 10% of Hawaiians are Latino. That's more than 120,000 people. Puerto Ricans form the largest group. They're followed by Mexicans. There are also Cubans, Dominicans, and South Americans. But the Hispanic presence on the islands actually goes back centuries to the Spanish.
We have Francisco Marin, the Spaniard, that came over in 1794.
That's Jose Villa, a longtime Hawaii resident and founder of Hawaii Hispanic News.
He also planted the first pineapple in the kingdom of Hawaii.
After the Spaniards, says Villa, Puerto Ricans came in the 19th century to work on the island's sugarcane fields. And when herds of cattle were overrunning the big island, Hawaiian King Kamehameha III brought cowboys over from Mexico. These so-called paniolos not only brought in new ranching techniques, their music also influenced Hawaii's slack key guitar style.
Yeah. So this is my humble abode. And then you see a lot of cars. I'm into cars. I guess it's the Mexican blood in me, you know, like those big old gaudy classic cars.
In a modest Ewa Beach neighborhood near Honolulu, 51-year-old Donald Gonzalez shows off his collection of vintage cars. He's a more recent arrival with Mexican roots. When he was just 2, his mother brought him and his sister from California.
In 1964, there weren't too many Mexicans, so I never learned the culture. She tried to teach us the language, but it wasn't of any use at that time, you know.
What Gonzalez and his family did find in Hawaii was friendliness and a spirit of welcome.
In Hawaii, we have what they call calabash or hanai. That means to be adopted into a family. So all my family here, black uncles, and I have our African-American uncles and Japanese aunties and Chinese cousins and Korean brothers and Vietnamese sisters, you know, so although I'm Mexican by blood, I'm Hawaiian and all these other nationalities by heart.
It's easy for Latinos to feel at home here, says Gonzalez. He says they share similarities with the indigenous culture and the respect for the land.
In fact, if you're Latino or brown skin and you come here, the local people here, islander people here, will get along more with you than we will a white person we call haole, because of, you know, they still got that mentality of Captain Cook and how the white man came and stole the land. You know, we're just like the Indians, you know, we lost a lot to the white man.
On Sunday morning, patrons gather for breakfast at Coquito's Latin Cuisine. There are Native Hawaiian families, white couples, Puerto Ricans and others. Owner Stevina Quiabo.
Well, I was actually born and raised in Puerto Rico. My dad is from Hong Kong, China. And my mom is actually from Cali, Colombia.
Many Latinos, including Quiabo's brother-in-law, came here because they've been stationed on one of Hawaii's many military bases, and they find they like it here. The cost of living may be high, but unemployment and crime are relatively low. Most of all, there's what Stevina calls the aloha spirit.
It's very, very gorgeous. It's soothing. And I think people feel that once they actually step into this island, they can feel that aloha and they can actually feel that calmness. Like no rush, no need to rush. Just look around, just enjoy.
There is one thing that is moving quickly in Hawaii, though. As of the last census in 2010, Latinos are now the fastest growing ethnic group in the Aloha State. For Latino USA, I'm Maria Martin in Haleiwa, Hawaii.
And now, dear listeners, we're going to hop back to the Caribbean. The Dominican Republic has the third highest teen pregnancy rate in Latin America. One in four teenage girls gets pregnant. In the U.S., by contrast, that number is one in 20. The Dominican Republic has been trying to lower their teen pregnancy rate since 2002, and it's tried to lower rates while at the same time respecting religious sensibilities. Whereas here in the United States, some states focused on teaching abstinence, in the Dominican Republic, they focused on teaching morals and values. It didn't work in either place. The abstinence-only states in the United States actually ended up with the highest teen pregnancy rates. Now, a new program with more funding is being pushed in the DR, still using a similar strategy, but will it have an impact without teaching contraception? Katie Manning has the story from Santo Domingo.
Yasreci Brito nurses her two-day-old baby girl named Jasmine in her left hand. An IV, haphazardly secured with scotch tape, delivers fluids into her right. The friendly 21-year-old got married at 12 to her father's coworker, who was twice her age. She had her first of six C-section deliveries at 15.
La verdad que no, porque uno después que tú lo tienes.
I wasn't ready, really, because it changes your life when you have a baby. Your life isn't the same. You have to take care of them, feed them, things like that. But they're my kids anyways, and I love them, and now I feel ready.
Yasreci lies in her hospital room. It's 95 degrees here. She's surrounded by two dozen mothers and their families. By each bed, there's a rusty oxygen tank. They're in the Alta Gracia Hospital in the country's capital. More babies are born here than anywhere else in the country. 31% of these babies have teen moms. Yasreci's mother begged her not to have children so young. After all, she was only 14 herself when Yasreci was born. But Yasreci says she didn't listen. She dropped out of public school in sixth grade to get married. And says it's been tough raising five kids.
Ooh, claro. No fácil.
They live in Boca Chica, about 15 miles east of Santo Domingo. Her husband works all day, building the resorts towering over their neighborhood.
Porque a veces no hay dinero suficiente que tiene que comprarle que si se enferma.
Sometimes there isn't enough money. One kid will get sick and you'll have to buy him medicine, and then another kid catches it, and so on. It's difficult, but you have to survive.
Hay que sobrevivir.
One of the hardest things is that Yasreci's eldest hasn't started school yet.
No, porque él tiene problemas.
He has problems. It's epilepsy, seizures. He has to be in a special school, but so far I haven't been able to send him to one.
Odds are against Yasreci going back to school. She's not alone. About 40% of Dominicans leave school before eighth grade, and for the girls, it's often because they get pregnant. So the government is launching a mandatory sex education program this coming January in all public schools. But Deputy Minister of Education Luis Matos says they won't learn about condoms, or any birth control.
La Iglesia Católica, por ejemplo, tiene una posición radicalmente opuesta a que se utilice ese.
The Catholic Church, for example, is radically opposed to preventing pregnancies this way. Considering this, we shouldn't use it in schools.
The country is 69% Catholic, and the government is full of politicians backed by the Catholic Church, including Luis Matos.
El sistema educativo atiende mejor el componente educativo.
The education system is better equipped to teach values so that a teenager's decision to start having sex happens when they reach the level of maturity needed to understand the consequences of those actions.
Siempre se alega que la Iglesia Católica está ahí, que la Iglesia Católica está vigilante, pero para mí, esas son.
People blame the Catholic Church, but for me, these are excuses. We as voters choose the Catholic Church. That's director of Pro Familia, Mirna Flores. Pro Familia teaches what no one at public schools will. It educates teens about contraception and pushes for more liberal sex education policies.
Como institución, siempre hemos trabajado de cerca en las escuelas y en las comunidades.
We set ourselves up in the communities near schools, but there's a lot of resistance. At home, teens often can't get information about condoms and birth control, especially in rural areas. Only half the population has internet access. The head of Altagracia Hospital, Victor Calderon, says girls are completely uninformed about their bodies. They come into the hospital not knowing that condoms could have prevented their pregnancies.
Kids need to learn how to avoid getting each other pregnant. How could we keep them from having sex? It's not possible.
As a Catholic, Victor Calderon is against abortions. They've also been completely illegal since 2009, even in cases of rape or if the mother's life is in danger. So most poor teen mothers drop out of school, never make it to university, and are stuck in poverty. Or they can risk their lives getting an illegal abortion. Calderon says the only way to break this cycle is to teach teenagers about birth control and safe sex.
Que se contradice, porque si nosotros no educamos a la población a darle la alternativa de método.
It's a contradiction because if we don't educate the population about contraception to keep teenagers from getting pregnant, then they can't avoid unwanted children that will result in abortions.
The abortion ban can harm those who need help the most. Wealthier people don't have to go to a shoddy facility to have an abortion. They fly to Puerto Rico or Miami. Jose Lopez grew up in the beachside town of La Romana. Here, the Domino's Sugar Company owns a country club community, including a private English school. Jose Lopez graduated from there. He says no one got pregnant, and they had a sex education without government censorship.
Because it was a British school, they were very frank with us, and there was an open dialogue, and I thought it was pretty useful. Basically, they taught us about the use of condoms. They taught us about other kind of forms of contraceptives.
Lopez says parents on the island normally don't have a sex talk with their kids. But Lopez's dad is a doctor and told him about contraception early.
I found myself explaining to my friends a lot of things about sex. I had a friend who at age 16 asked me if he could get his girlfriend pregnant from her giving him a blow at age 16 from a well-educated family.
Talking about sex is taboo, but that isn't stopping teens from having sex and having children at a young age. For Latino USA, this is Katie Manning in Santo Domingo.
Coming up on Latino USA.
Part of going to Cuba was to find out if I was responsible in some way for his alcoholism.
Journalist Daisy Hernandez searches for the strength to forgive. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Me despierto en el alba, soñando no sé qué. Desayuno con lluvia y te recuerdo. Yeah.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week, we're talking about islands at sea and in the heartland, in a place like North Dakota. The oil boom has turned that state into an island of new jobs and bursting economic growth. Thousands of people, including Latinos, are flocking from all over the U.S. to work in the oil industry boom. In fact, in 2012, North Dakota was the state with the largest growth of Latino settlers in the country. We now hear the story of Juan Beltran, president of the Latino American Student Organization at the University of North Dakota. Juan is from California, and he tells us what led him to the Peace Garden State.
Hi, my name is Juan Beltran. I am 22 years old from Stockton, California, a senior in biology at the University of North Dakota. I decided really to go to North Dakota on a whim. I read online about all these things going on over there, and in California I had a job and everything, but it really, the pay couldn't even compare, so I guess I just decided to come over here and try my luck or something, I guess. When I moved to Williston, I got a job from a temp agency at a shop that sells materials for drillers for oil rigs. After that, I had quite a bit of money saved up, and I was able to start my undergraduate career at UND. I didn't have to take any loans or anything because I was able to afford UND with my scholarships and my financial aid and the money I had saved. Well, actually, a lot of students here where the oil boom is prominent, they actually work in oil-related businesses during their summer breaks, and they also make pretty good money. And when they come back to school, they don't have to work the entire school year because they have enough money saved up from the summer. So, I mean, working in the winter kind of stinks because, really, your face burns. If you don't wear, like, a good scarf, your face will burn, and it hurts a lot. Other Latinos that I met up here, they came up here mostly for school because it's really affordable. City's affordable. School's affordable. Everything's affordable compared to, say, California. You can easily get a roommate and pay $200 and look comfortable. Haven't really decided if I really want to stay up here after I'm done with my postgraduate school, but this wouldn't be a very bad choice.
Our television show, America by the Numbers, with Maria Hinojosa on PBS and the World Channel, has our own story about the oil boom in North Dakota. More on that at the end of our show. Anyone who's moved to a new place knows how hard it can be to get comfortable. There's always an adjustment period. But sometimes the culture gap between what you're used to and where you're trying to fit in is so big, you can feel isolated. This summer, reporter Nina Feldman took a trip to rural Paraguay to visit some Peace Corps volunteers there. They go to help people, but they often find that just being themselves can be the hardest part.
Okay, so today we want gloves and our little veils. We want machetes just mostly to clear the area around the hive.
That's my friend Julia Wenzel. She's suiting up to go out to the beehive in the field behind her house.
There they all are. Those are all worker bees.
Julia lives in a community called Rincon Guasu in rural Paraguay. She's there because a women's gardening committee asked for a Peace Corps volunteer to help create family gardens. Beekeeping is a common project for agriculture volunteers in the Peace Corps.
People are crazy for honey here. You can have a sustainable practice where you're having, I don't know, dozens of liters a year, and you're selling each of those liters for $10 or whatever. That's a lot of money for a subsistence farming family.
When you think of the Peace Corps, you usually think of Americans bringing aid to communities in developing countries. But American volunteers are also supposed to learn about another culture, and vice versa. That's Julia, talking with Mercedes Tiaria, a member of the gardening committee that requested a Peace Corps volunteer.
Our job is never to say, you should do this. Our job is to facilitate conversations over and 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 over again until finally some kind of project was brought up from the community itself. And then we figure out ways to support it.
So the first part of Julia's job is to figure out what her job is. Julia thought beekeeping could be great. It's cheap. It requires very little work. The product is valuable. But there's one thing she didn't count on.
Men are always like, oh, you make honey? Like, great, I really love honey because it's supposed to be an aphrodisiac.
So unfortunately, a lot of the men are more interested in her than in the bees.
Oh, basically, Julia coming by and saying that she wants to go beekeeping with me is an invitation.
So far, Julia hasn't been able to get anybody to start keeping bees. But she can't force it.
Absolutely, my philosophy is, like, don't be a jerk. Don't come in and think you know better than people who've been making it work here.
In the Peace Corps, like anywhere, if you want people to see things your way, you've got to earn their trust. And to earn their trust, you've got to show that you understand them and their way of life. But that can take a lot out of you, especially if you're staying put for 2 years.
My social life are my members of my community, and that's more work sometimes than my work.
About an hour down the red clay road from Rincon Guasu, where Julia lives, the local bus line passes an unmarked intersection. There's nothing to see for miles but sugarcane fields and roaming cattle. This is the stop for Nuai Uno.
For me, it felt like being in like a middle of a hurricane. Like everything was like whirling around me.
This is where another Peace Corps volunteer, Nick Fisher, lives.
I could never like really get my feet on the ground because you're all day learning a new language and in a weird culture and all these things. So yeah, like everything was uncomfortable.
Nuai is a good 3 miles down the road from the bus stop. So unless he can catch a ride on an ox cart, Nick usually hoofs it to and from town. The bus only runs when the roads have been dry for days, so in the rainy season, getting home, or getting away from home, is never a given. Nick feels isolated for other reasons, too.
I think every volunteer would say that they can only share so much of who they are here. For me, that's my sexuality, for sure, is my number one. And something comfortable was happening over here with this guy.
Nick and his boyfriend, another volunteer, would meet once a month or so in Asuncion, the capital. It's a 7-hour trip from Nuai. While Nick looks at his trips to the city as a chance to let loose, he faces a lot of discrimination there, too. Like when hotel clerks would tell him that two boys can't share a room with a single bed.
Well, I like to tell myself that, like, I'm not bothered by someone that believes that what I'm doing is wrong. It does bother me that I can't bring you on my side and I can't prove to you that, like, I'm a good person. I'm not doing anything wrong here.
Nick and his boyfriend aren't dating anymore, so Nick doesn't have as many reasons to leave Nuai. And here, it's even harder to feel like he fits in.
Like, I'm not interested in going and playing soccer with a bunch of men my age that are going to sit there and just ask me how much I've got this week. Like, there's only so many times you can laugh it off.
Nick says that while being gay may not be the first thing he'd say about himself back in the States, having to hide it has made him realize what a big part of his identity it is.
Like, I don't shake hands with every American I meet and say, this is my name and this is my sexuality. And yet, some of my closest friends here, they're never going to know that about me. They're never going to understand that.
For some volunteers, fitting in doesn't feel so out of reach. Marin Saley lives in a small farming town called Blanchada, where she has a big backyard filled with chickens and turkeys and a pig she bought from the family down the road. When Julia and I get there, she's just getting back from her neighbor's house across the street with a steaming pan of zucchini bread. She uses the oven over there because it's more reliable than her own. But Marin wasn't always so plugged in to her community, until Miguel came along.
Before I met him, it was really hard being here alone.
When she first moved to Planchada, Marin just wanted to hide in her house all day.
The first time I ever met him, I remember looking across the way, and he was cutting down his trees, and I remember being like, that hair. I went over there and we started talking. He was telling me how much he wanted to learn about beekeeping. And then he had a chainsaw. So I was like, okay, he's got the big three. He's got great hair. He wants to learn about bees and he has power tools. I'm in love.
When Marin arrived in Paraguay, her Spanish was really bad. She could talk about colors, food, days of the week. That's pretty much it. It has come a long way. And it's because of Miguel.
Hands down, he's the reason. And he's funny, and, like, I can't even explain it. Like, he makes me laugh. We make it work. We both watch Game of Thrones. Like, at the end of the night, like, I can tell him what I'm upset about, and he can tell me what he's upset about.
For Marin, dating Miguel has made it possible to get to know people in Planchada in a way that otherwise would have been next to impossible.
Like, they're just like, oh, you have a boyfriend. Cool. Yeah, no, come in. Like, I just feel like they weren't just like, oh, she's this weird American.
But no matter how comfortable her relationship is and how much it's shaped her experience, Marin says that in some ways, she and Miguel are just too different. She says that lately, as her time in Paraguay nears an end,
Miguel has started asking her what it would take for him to move to the U.S. with her.
And then I said, you're going to have to understand that women and men ideally are on the same level. I mean, it's more of a team, of a partnership. And so I said, you know, you get all excited when you do a couple dishes. That's not the way it works. But I don't think he has any idea what he'd be getting himself into.
So what do you think is going to happen?
We're not going to stay together. Like, he's going to find himself a nice Paraguayan or Argentinian girl and settle down. And I'd like to think that our relationship will alter the way that he treats her and helps out. But no, I can't stay in his world and he can't come to mine.
What if he met your terms? Your U.S. terms?
He can't meet those. And I wouldn't want to ask him to do that. That's unfair.
Why?
Because it's changing what he knows is, like, the norm.
Whether it has a future or not, Marin's relationship with Miguel works as a coping mechanism for her. And without one, it sounds like people go a little crazy. There are all sorts of cautionary tales about what happens when volunteers spend too much time alone. Like one young woman who hadn't been heard from in weeks. When the Peace Corps doctors finally checked on her, they found her in the kitchen, nailing pancakes to the walls. Then, Julia tells me about the volunteer who would watch each day as a cow came into her yard and ate the underwear off her clothesline. One day, she snapped and stabbed the cow to death with a steak knife.
Some people thought, like, oh my God, how could that ever happen? And I swear to God, I know which cows I would stab.
So how do you make a difference when you don't fit in the first place?
I put my guard in by the road. Mm.
Julia says that leading by example is the best way and the most comfortable way to influence anyone. Instead of saying, you should do this, you have to say, this is what works for me. On one of my last days at Rincon Guasu, Julia and I go to visit Mercedes. She's a part of the gardening committee that requested Julia in the first place. Mercedes gives us a bag full of fresh eggs from her chicken coop and a tour of her bountiful and impressive garden.
Remedios naturales, cenizas, lo que siempre les pongo.
Y eso sirve.
Sí.
Con casi cada tipo de bicho que viene o...
Mercedes gives Julia advice on the best herbal remedies to keep the pests off her plants. Julia learns a lot from Mercedes. In fact, she says it feels like the community members can teach her as much about gardening as she teaches them. Considering how hard it can feel to be the odd one out, Julia finds herself wondering if it's worth it at all to have a Peace Corps volunteer trying to help. She leaves Paraguay in November. Between now and then, she, Mercedes, and the rest of Rincon Guasu have to decide together if they should ask the Peace Corps to send a new volunteer in her place. For Latino USA, I'm Nina Feldman in Rincon Guasu, Paraguay.
And this week, for our sabiduría, or words of wisdom, we turn to Daisy Hernandez. Daisy is a journalist who recently published a memoir titled A Cup of Water Under My Bed. In the memoir, she reveals some very personal experiences about her life growing up in New Jersey with immigrant parents from Colombia and Cuba. She shares with us the story of how she went to her father's homeland, the island of Cuba, and learned there to forgive him.
It was actually a meditation that I had read in a book to think about my father or the parent or whoever the sort of person was that had hurt you as being a young child themselves. And I didn't have any pictures of my father as a child from Cuba. This is also part of growing up in the diaspora, that we don't necessarily have images of our parents as children, and we don't necessarily have as much extended family to also give us images of our parents. But this image of him came up with this little curly hair, and I could see him as sort of tender and vulnerable himself. And that was really, that really helped me in a way to have some level of forgiveness. I did go to Cuba in 2000. Part of going to Cuba was to
find out if I was responsible in some way for his alcoholism, because I had been told that he really started drinking after I was born. And I had just that idea sort of seared into my head that I was sort of the root cause of this. And so I went to Havana and then made the sort of longer trip to the town where he had grown up and was going to stay with the uncle who had raised him, who's basically like a father to him. What I discovered is that he had a really different image of himself than other people had of him. So when I was in Cuba, it was this amazing opportunity to hear how other people had seen him as a child, and where my father saw himself as being un huérfano, very, very orphaned, because his mother died when he was born and his dad had pretty much left. Other people saw him as un niño consentido, that he had been spoiled, he'd had his own horse at one point, he had a cat that ate with him. These things were sort of the markers of having been spoiled in this countryside in Cuba. And that really gave me a more three-dimensional picture of him. There was this one point where his uncle said to me that my dad's grandmother used to call him El Feito, the ugly one. And there was something about hearing this idea that, like, his own grandmother had been, whether joking or not, you know, told him that he was this little ugly boy, really touched my heart. And then, you know, my uncle was telling me, oh, but your dad would always say, like, but mis ojos, because someone had told him that he had beautiful eyes. And so this idea that he was this little boy in Cuba who had been trying to insist on his own beauty just really resonated with me as actually being my own journey as well.
Well, mis queridos, that's it for this week's Latino USA. Thanks so much for listening. Now, I want to invite you to another cultural island of sorts. It's Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. On PBS and on the World Channel, our TV show, America by the Numbers, with Maria Hinojosa, is looking at a different type of white flight. It's white migration to even whiter areas. Check your local listings or visit americabythenumbers.org for more details and let us know what you think. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Laura Calzada and Julia Hsu. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on PBS and the World Channel. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Funding for Latino USA's coverage of a culture of health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
It's in my trusty cup holder.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. This is NPR.